This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 19th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, youth protesters in Florida continue an occupation of the governor's office, demanding a special legislative session to address the Trayvon Martin killing, as nationwide rallies aim to pressure the Justice Department to pursue federal charges against George Zimmerman. Municipalities in Illinois rush to meet today's deadline to pass gun control measures. And we'll sit down with a farm worker advocate from California who's in the nation's capital to call for stronger rules on chemicals and pesticides on U.S. farms. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights challenged the U.S. drone killings of three American citizens. The groups filed a lawsuit on behalf of Nasser al-Awlaki, whose son Anwar and grandson Abdul Rahman were killed in two separate strikes. Another plaintiff is Sarah Khan, whose son Samir was also killed in one of the attacks. FSRN's Ben King reports from the Capitol.
The lawsuit argues that the men's constitutional rights were violated when they were killed in drone strikes in Yemen in 2011. Abdul Rahman was 16 years old at the time. His grandfather describes him as a typical teenager who watched The Simpsons, listened to Snoop Dogg, read Harry Potter, and had a Facebook page with many friends. al-Awlaki versus Panetta is the latest in a series of lawsuits and FOIA requests that seek answers and accountability for the CIA's targeted killing program. Today, lawyers from the ACLU argued that the court needs to protect the constitutional rights of the victims, especially the right to due process guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment. The ACLU's Brett Kaufman warned that this case could set a dangerous precedent.
I think today's argument really brings into stark relief the consequences of the government's position as to whether it may be brought into court when it violates the rights of its citizens. The government's argument boils down to trust us when national security is involved.
District Court Judge Rosemary Collier will review the case and issue a decision as to whether the government can be put on trial for the killings, although it's unclear when the decision will come. Ben King, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Detroit has become the largest U.S. city ever to file for bankruptcy. Reaction to the announcement has been mixed, with some saying Chapter 9 bankruptcy will allow the city to get out from under its crushing debt and start fresh. Other groups are voicing anger. Today, the president of AFSCME, the union representing public employees, said the city did not negotiate with the union and filing for bankruptcy threatened worker pensions. The proposal was put forward by the city emergency financial manager, who was appointed by Republican Governor Rick Snyder. A day after four civilians were shot and killed by paramilitary troops during a protest in Indian-administered Kashmir, authorities issued curfews in several major towns to prevent large-scale protests. FSRN's Shanawaz Khan has the story.
Initially, six people were reported dead, but officials put the number of civilian fatalities at the hands of border security force at four today. More than 40 people were injured in the incident. Most parts of the Muslim-dominated Kashmir Valley were placed under curfew as separatists called for a general shutdown. Despite the restrictions, minor clashes between demonstrators and police have been reported in some areas, including Ramban district, where the shootings took place. Authorities stopped Hindu pilgrims traveling through Ramban to a Himalayan shrine for fear of retaliatory attack by locals. Officials, however, said the situation was largely under control. After the civilian shootings and outcry yesterday, the border security force vacated their post in the town where the shooting took place. The paramilitary group was in charge of guarding construction of a new railway line. Local police have taken over the post. Shanawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Today, a Russian court unexpectedly decided to release well-known opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Just yesterday, Navalny was sentenced to 5 years in prison on charges of embezzlement in a case widely criticized as political. The court decision follows a night of protests in cities across Russia. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
People shouted shame and fascists as the police arrested about 60 activists at an unsanctioned gathering in St. Petersburg in support of Alexei Navalny. Thousands gathered in Moscow, where unsanctioned protests continued into the night, leading to more than 200 arrests. Navalny told reporters that the rallies influenced the court's decision to release him until his sentence comes into force 2 months from now. It's likely that Navalny can now take part in the election for mayor of Moscow, but he's threatening to boycott instead.
I'm not their pet kitten or puppy whom they first removed from elections. You won't take part, they said. Then they said, no, let's give him 1 month to take part in the elections.
Navalny says he will discuss his options with supporters. He also says he will continue the work he started with the opposition movement, which seems to be re-energized as a result of his conviction. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. Today, President Barack Obama addressed the killing of Trayvon Martin in his first remarks since a jury found George Zimmerman not guilty of the shooting death of the unarmed Florida teen last week. Obama said the nationwide response should be viewed in the context of racial injustice.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me. 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away.
Obama said that includes a history of racial disparity in how the U.S. judicial system is applied, such as with the death penalty or in enforcing drug laws, and a history in which virtually all people of color have experienced people locking car doors or clutching purses in their presence. The president said measures such as Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which allows residents to use deadly force, should be scrutinized.
On the other hand, if we're sending a message as a society in our communities that someone who is armed potentially has the right to use those firearms, even if there's a way for them to exit from a situation, is that really going to be contributing to the kind of peace and security and order that we'd like to see?
The Stand Your Ground law has received increased criticism after the Zimmerman acquittal, and it's a central focus of protesters in Tallahassee who continue for a fourth day to occupy the offices of Governor Rick Scott. They're calling on Scott to convene a special legislative session to pass a Trayvon Martin Civil Rights Act and repeal the state's Stand Your Ground law. For more, FSRN spoke with one of the protesters at the Capitol, Michael Sampson, a student at Florida State University and one of the organizers with Dream Defenders. He joined us by mobile phone and began by describing the latest at Governor Scott's office.
Right now, the scene is around 25 to 30 determined youth still here, occupying the governor's office, making sure that his office understands that we're not leaving. We met with him last night. Our demands were not met. And because of that, you know, we're still here to make sure, you know, Governor Scott called a special session to pass the Trayvon Martin Act, being a repeal of Stand Your Ground law, into racial profiling, and also an end to school-to-prison pipeline here in Florida, and we're going to be here until those demands are met.
After the meeting last night, Governor Scott did release a statement. He did not agree to call for a special legislative session. Instead, he said he agreed with the state task force that defended the Stand Your Ground law. They issued their findings earlier this year. He also said, quote, "I also reminded them, protesters, of their right to share their views with their state legislators and let them know their opinions on the law." Michael Sampson, your response to Governor Scott?
The response to Governor Scott is that's contingent on the idea that youth and Junior and Congenital haven't already done that. Last session, we were very actively involved in pushing reforms. We were here talking to our legislators and making our voices heard, but obviously that voice wasn't heard loud enough by Governor Scott and by our legislators. So that's why we're here, you know. And standing ground law does disproportionately affect black and brown people in the state of Florida compared to other people more. So it's definitely has a very racial biased effect as affecting our youth and it's affecting our children. So we're here, and you know, we're here to make sure that those voices are heard and cause external pressure to Governor Scott to make sure that he has our concerns and calls for the special session of legislature.
Michael Sampson is a student at Florida State University, also an organizer with Dream Defenders. The group is occupying Governor Rick Scott's offices in Florida. They're calling for a special legislative session to repeal the Stand Your Ground law in the state. Michael Sampson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
This Saturday, activists are planning to rally in 100 cities across the nation in front of federal buildings. They're calling on the Department of Justice to bring federal charges against George Zimmerman. If convicted of a hate crime, Zimmerman could face up to life in prison. For more on potential civil rights charges, we're joined by James Eichner. He's a former investigator and attorney at the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice and currently the managing director of programs at the Advancement Project. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
The NAACP says more than 1 million people have signed a petition this week calling on the Department of Justice to file civil rights charges against Zimmerman for the killing of Trayvon Martin. What specific charges are possible in this case?
Sure. So the main statute that is at issue here is the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act of 2009. That act was named after Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr., Matthew Shepard being the victim of a hate crime against him based on his sexual orientation, and Mr. Byrd the victim of a hate crime in Texas that was motivated by him being an African American. And so that statute is a hate crime statute, and it's meant to criminalize federal crimes when you create bodily injury to someone because of their race or based on some other criteria, but race being most germane here. So that's the question for the Department of Justice, is do they think that a crime was committed against Trayvon Martin because of his race? Because certainly he was subject to bodily injury, so that's not an issue. So the question really is the federal government able to prove that Trayvon Martin died because of his race?
The judge in the criminal case in Florida specifically instructed attorneys to avoid discussing race in the trial, but that does appear to go to one of the central questions of why Zimmerman targeted Trayvon Martin. So if these federal charges were filed, racial profiling could be a major factor in the charges?
It would have to be the central aspect of the charges. And, you know, the judge may have been correct to give that instruction in the case under the criminal law of Florida, but that doesn't change the fact that this case is really about race. I mean, I think the one thing that cannot be disputed by anyone is if Trayvon Martin had been white, he would be alive today, and that Mr. Zimmerman followed him because of his race and the perception that he had that because of his race and because of where he was, that he was a threat to the community and therefore took it upon him to follow him.
So the Department of Justice said it is conducting an investigation along with the FBI and the state's attorney's office for the Middle District of Florida. As they go through this investigation, what is the criteria for determining if federal charges can be filed? What are they looking for?
Yeah. So what they're looking for is evidence of racial animus. And I think, you know, the problem here is that historically, when we think of racial animus, we think about things that are so blatant, like a noose or a racial slur. And it doesn't appear that those are at issue here. But I think, you know, that doesn't mean that race wasn't the motivating factor here. I think it's clear that, you know, Mr. Zimmerman had a view of Trayvon Martin that was informed by his race.
As we've said, this is taking place within the Department of Justice's criminal section of the Civil Rights Division. James Eichner, in your role at the Civil Rights Division, you supervised investigations and litigation. How does this division work, and what timeline will it pursue?
So I was in the civil part of the, which is a different part than the criminal part, but we often work together. You know, so the way it works is it's usually attorneys from the main Department of Justice in D.C., and they usually work with the local U.S. attorney in the district in which the crime happened. And the timeline varies greatly. It's not unusual, as happened in this case, for the federal government to wait until a local prosecution happens and then proceed with its investigation in earnest, which is what seems to have happened here. You know, it may take a while to do this. I hope that they can move quickly. I think there's a real need for the public to have the confidence that the Justice Department is working hard on this and is, you know, not letting the fact that it happened a while ago and that this may be a difficult case stand in the way of a active and effective investigation.
James Eichner is a former investigator and attorney at the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, currently the managing director of programs at the Advancement Project. He joined us to discuss the legal aspects of possible federal charges against George Zimmerman for the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. James Eichner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dorian. I appreciate it.
Municipalities in Illinois rushed to meet today's deadline to pass gun reform measures. The state gave local lawmakers 10 days to do so after lifting the last remaining prohibition on concealed firearms in the nation. Earlier this week, Chicago's city council passed a bill expanding the types of arms included in its existing assault weapons ban and increasing some penalties. A suburb to the north, Evanston, voted unanimously to implement an assault weapons ban. FSRN's Jay Saper reports from Evanston.
The city of Chicago regularly grabs headlines for gun violence. Nearly 90% of the city's 500 homicides last year were gun-related deaths, and many more were injured in shootings. While that spotlight remains on Chicago, a suburb just north is also experiencing some gun violence. Three murders within the city last year, including a 14-year-old, another shooting death of an Evanston man in Chicago in May, and gunshots fired across from a high school in June, has made community members uneasy. In response, Evanston's town council began taking steps to stiffen gun laws and voted unanimously July 15th in favor of a ban on assault weapons. Alderpersons were urged to do so by Carolyn Murray, a longtime anti-violence activist whose 19-year-old son Justin was killed last year in a drive-by shooting outside his grandmother's house. Murray was among a couple dozen residents commenting at the council hearing.
Justin could still be here. And I don't like to share this side of me because you know that we have done prayer marches. The alderman and I talked this morning. We're getting ready for National Night Out next month. But this has got to end. It is just the beginning. The assault weapons is just the beginning.
Murray often brings a large photo of her son to council meetings. But in the wake of George Zimmerman's acquittal, she held a picture of Florida shooting victim Trayvon Martin. And later explained to FSRN why.
Oh, the connection is that he's a youth with so much future and so much brightness ahead, and a very simple task can get you killed. Just like I relay it with my son, Justin, just a very simple task, going to visit your grandmother, can get you killed.
Some residents oppose the measure, including single mom Millie Herzani and sportsman Mike Rice.
As a woman who has been stalked, harassed, followed, to please not infringe on my right to keep and bear arms. Please do not restrict gun ownership.
I was there and I listened to all kinds of people talking about all kinds of programs, but I really didn't hear enough about crime control. But that's what there is here. There's a problem with crime caused by criminals and criminal acts.
But local lawmakers said amendments to the bill ensure First Amendment rights will be protected. Alderman Don Wilson.
The proposal does what I think that my constituents expect. It's to ban the highly dangerous weapons, high-capacity magazines, bullet-piercing, armor-piercing bullets, things of that nature, and to not ban an ordinary hunting rifle.
Law enforcement also responded to Evanston violence, holding two gun buyback events in 6 months. Both netted only some 80 firearms. Police also announced in June that their stop-and-frisk program would be expanded. The same program in New York has resulted in extensive racial profiling, few arrests, and has been challenged in court. High school student B.J. Hamilton says he's concerned about racial profiling.
I don't think it's the right thing because it's very discriminating. I'm not very offended by too many racial jokes or tomfoolery. It doesn't really matter to me. As long as I know I'm innocent, I'm innocent.
Some are trying to bring the community together. Murray, who was invited to the President's State of the Union this year, led hundreds of marchers arm and arm in a prayerful anti-gun rally last month. And in the fight for peace, B.J. Hamilton's weapon of choice is dance.
I try and stop it however I can. Actually, 2 days ago, I performed a dance at a peace rally that was held at Evanston Township High School at the football field. Basically exhibit what you do rather than violent actions and just try and be peaceful. Try and stop what's going on in the community that's endangering us.
While Evanston, Chicago, and a number of other municipalities beat the state's 10-day deadline to establish their own gun control laws, many didn't take up any measures and some were defeated. But gun control efforts aren't ending here. Civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton says he's moving to Chicago this fall in order to bring more national attention to the problem and help local activists continue their campaigns to reduce gun violence. Jay Saper, FSRN, Evanston, Illinois.
This week, farm workers from across the country came to Washington, D.C. to demand stronger regulations for pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, and other chemicals used by farm workers. Traveling from California, Florida, Ohio, Minnesota, and other states, the farm workers said the regulations the Environmental Protection Agency approved 20 years ago are outdated and poorly enforced, and that many are suffering serious health impacts as a result. FSRN's Alice Olstein sat down with Millie Trevino Saucedo, a farm labor organizer from California who worked in the fields herself as a child and was part of this week's delegation.
I come from a migrant farm worker family. I started working very, very, very young. I was 8 years old in Idaho, but not until I came to California with my family as a teenager. We learned about the United Farm Workers, but that was after the fact that our family had been exposed to pesticides, where planes were spraying the chemicals and we were working. And of course, I was very, very happy in 1992 when the work protection standards were developed. And sad to say, these regulations were very weak, because the kind of training that was provided, the video or whatever training they're saying that they're providing is training that many workers do not understand. And at the same time, a lot of times the companies are just having, the crew leaders are just having the workers sign a paper saying that they have been trained, when workers don't even understand because it's in English, or even if it's in Spanish, some of them don't read or write. And then whenever they would try to ask anything, the workers would be told by the crew leaders, you're a troublemaker, you're asking too many questions, either you like it or there's many other waiting in line to get your job. Or some of them that if they're undocumented, they prefer not to say anything because they think that if they do anything, who's the one that knows that they don't have documentation? The crew leader that hired them. So they know they could be, you know, deported. Or they're threatened by that.
And what specific changes do you think are necessary?
that companies be required, not every 5 years for a worker to be trained. Companies hire at a, even sometimes on a daily basis, new workers. So they need to be training workers, and 15, 20 minutes is not enough for someone to really understand how they can prevent from being poisoned. And we need to make sure that the training be very culturally appropriate and in the language that the worker can understand.
And you said you and your family were exposed by a plane spraying while you were out working in the fields. Yes. Does that still happen, or are people exposed in other ways now?
Oh, it's still happening that same way. This is why we're angry, because when that happened to me, it was around 30 years ago. I was working in this field, and this plane was, you know, over us and throwing, you know, applying the chemicals, and we were there working. And you know how we used to feel, and this is how I know people feel still? It's like when you're fumigating insects, you know, to get rid of insects. It's like, this is how we felt. You know, they're doing all these fumigation around the fields, the orchards, and workers are there, and we're treated like insects. That's very humiliating. It's like not being respectful in terms of us. We're like, if we have no dignity or anything like that. That's it's uncalled for. It's really uncalled for.
And what kinds of health impacts have you seen with the workers that you've worked with?
Many workers, and I also have family members that, because on a daily level, they are exposed, and they're exposed. There's a lot of like health problems that are related to cancer, throat problems, rashes. Some people started developing skin problems and lots of headaches and asthma. And we've known that some of these workers have died either of prostate cancer or other kind of cancer, like stomach cancer. And workers go to work and they bring the pesticide residue in their clothing because they're not trained, and they don't understand that all those residues, all those chemicals that they've been exposed to, they're bringing it home, and children are getting ill also.
And you're putting pressure on the EPA and on Congress to make these stronger rules. Do you also think the general public should have a role in this?
To start with, we think that the general public should also be informed about how important it is that, as a consumer, they understand that workers are being affected. And at the same time, we don't know what the chemical, you know, how the residue within the fruits and vegetables stay, and if that's going to affect them on the long run. And so and with Congress, we're asking for their support to really pressure EPA to take it more serious in terms of revising and updating to create stronger worker protection standards.
That was farm worker advocate Millie Trevino Saucedo speaking to FSRN's Washington correspondent Alice Olstein. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Wesley Burton. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can check out sights and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.